There's a difference between whether someone can use a gun and when they should use a gun. And we as a city must train for that difference.
Gee, Rom, you think?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
I am, right here. At the broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, on the Stitcher app, the TuneIn app, and Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. Of course, the broadcast is usually hosted by Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, but today, once again, you've got me, the blushing bride, Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com. Happy New Year. And yes, I am really guest hosting the broadcast on my wedding day. Seriously. Well, more about that later. But thankfully, most of the heavy lifting for today's show is already done by John Nichols and the good folks at The Nation magazine. But first, a bit of news. Accused serial rapist Bill Cosby was arraigned and freed on a $1 million bond on charges of aggravated indecent assault. And I gotta say, watching him do the perp walk back to the car was a thing of beauty. I know, innocent till proven guilty, but where there's that much smoke, just saying. And what a way to end the year, huh? Now, in Chicago, embattled Mayor Rahm Emanuel is still fighting off calls for his resignation as the Justice Department steps in to investigate the systemic use of force within the Chicago Police Department. The city was still reeling from the release of dash cam video showing a Chicago cop, Jason Van Dyke, shooting a black 17-year-old, Laquan McDonald, 16 times when the latest outrage happened. Yeah. It was early Tuesday morning, like, you know, middle of the night Tuesday morning, when Chicago police were involved in yet another shooting. This time, they killed two people, 19-year-old Quintonio LeGreer and 55-year-old Betty Jones. Police say that LeGreer was charging at officers when they opened fire. Jones, the downstairs neighbor, was accidentally shot and killed by police, authorities said. So, Rahm Emanuel held a press conference during which he announced new protocols within the Chicago police force. He said Chicago police officers will be trained to use and equipped with 1,400 stun guns, also known as tasers, by June of 2016. I guess a taser is better than a bullet, but maybe on the next broadcast, we can get Digby on to talk about tasers. She's done a lot of work in that area. Anyway, here's a little more of what Rahm Emanuel had to say at the press conference.
There's a difference between whether someone can use a gun and when they should use a gun. And we as a city must train for that difference. These changes are also not the first steps that we have taken as a city. We announced that any officer involved in shootings will be put on desk duty for 30 days so we can assess their fitness for duty. That's a change from 3 days. I also directed Interim Superintendent Escalante and Acting Head of IPRA, Independent Police Review Authority, Sharon Farrelly, to review the crisis response policies that are in place so that we can see what needs improvement and what needs to be changed. Today, we're taking additional steps to create more time and distance in these situations and other encounters to make environments safe and safer for all. We will improve communication between officers and individuals to make these encounters less confrontational and more conversational. And we will double the number of tasers to 1,400 while also providing officers the training to use them properly. With the right policies, the right procedures, and the right practices, we can change our officers' perspectives to help them ensure their own safety and the safety of others. We want to ensure that our officers are not just operating in either first gear or fifth gear, but to recognize the degrees in between so they can respond appropriately to each individual situation, where force can be the last option, not the first choice.
Yeah, good luck with that. And what took you so long? To be continued, all eyes on Chicago. We're watching you, Rahm. Now, if you were planning on ringing in the new year in Brussels, well, you're probably too late. You'll never get there in time. But that's okay, because you'd miss out on the fireworks. As authorities in the Belgian capital called off their traditional New Year's Eve fireworks display, citing fears of a terror attack. On Tuesday, federal prosecutors said two people suspected of plotting an attack in Brussels on New Year's Eve had been arrested during house searches in different parts of the country. And, well, on a related note, and to make us feel not quite so bad about our own Secret Service, there's this. Authorities in Belgium are investigating claims that a group of soldiers and police officers had an orgy during a four-day lockdown following the November terrorist attacks in Paris. Yeah, I can't make this stuff up. Two police officers and eight soldiers allegedly participated in the group sex act at a police station in the Ganshoren neighborhood of Brussels, according to a couple of Belgian newspapers. The incident occurred while police and military in the Molenbeek neighborhood to the south of the station searched for suspects with ties to the November 13th attacks in Paris. A police spokesman said that an internal investigation has been launched. I'll bet it has. And there is your look at the news. I can only imagine what it'll be like a year from now. All right, we'll take a break and come back on the other side with John Nichols of The Nation for our annual waltz through the Progressive Honor Roll, 2015 style. That's next. Stick around. I'm Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com, filling in on the broadcast. Oh, yeah, sing it, BB. I'll be bringing in a brand new year. Bringing in a brand new year. So listen, dear, won't you meet me here while bringing in a brand new year? Oh, yeah, and 2016 can only get better, right? Because look what we're leaving behind. Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com, filling in again today, and I'll be bringing in a brand new year. As a married woman, getting married tonight, seriously, I'm a glutton for punishment. What can I say? I'm not talking about the wedding. I'm talking about filling in for Brad and Desi on my wedding day. So let's get this party started, shall we? We spend a lot of time complaining, at least I do. You know, I complain because I care. But today, I thought this was a time to salute the best among us. And to do that, I enlist the help of an old friend, John Nichols. He is the Washington correspondent of The Nation magazine, although he's based in Madison, Wisconsin, go figure. And every year, he is at the helm of The Nation's annual Progressive Honor Roll. This is a tradition we've got. It's really your tradition. I just sort of jumped on the bandwagon.
You are now central to the tradition.
Oh, well, every year, The Nation magazine publishes their annual Progressive Honor Roll, honoring those who deserve to be honored. And every year, you and I go over the list and, you know, and sort of debate. We don't debate its merits. We heap on the praise because, you know, here's my thing. 2015, I think, John, was the year of ugliness and nastiness. The year, I think it's the Donald Trump effect, where people said, oh, if he can be an asshole, so can we. And so the gloves came off and the ugliness just sort of spewed forth. And so I think in an atmosphere like this, it's even more important to really thank the people who did, you know, praiseworthy work. And that's what you do with the Progressive Honor Roll each year.
Well, I appreciate your way of phrasing it. I think I agree with that very much. In fact, what I would suggest is that 2015 was the year of trying to out-Trump Trump. Mm. And so the really horrible politics of Donald Trump, and that includes, you know, bashing of immigrants, of refugees, mm-hmm. of religious minorities, the establishment of religious tests that go against everything that Americans should honor and value in our history. That became the baseline. And from that baseline, much like internet trolls, much of the rest of the Republican Party, and frankly, a lot of our media, extended. It went to uglier and more difficult places. And so in that context, where it is so easy to imagine a politics that is only about the negatives, only about, really, I would argue, going backward as a country.
Yeah.
Not making America great again, but making America into something that we never wanted it. In that context, it becomes vitally important to recognize the individuals, the institutions that have pushed back, not just pushed back, you know, in defense, but often pushed back on backward ideas and said, no, we can, even in these times, go forward. We can do great things. We can be a wonderful, loving, decent, humane, visionary country. And I know you do that with your show all the time.
I try.
And I appreciate, no, I really appreciate that. I think that's a big, big deal. You getting up every day, and I know it's not easy, and putting this out there. No, it's not. And and you're emblematic of a lot of this. You and I talk about it, so you rise up to this next status of, you know, being the observer. I obviously never put myself on the list. I don't put you on, but I certainly could, because the fact of the matter is, you know, it's there are these people across this country who actually believe it matters. It matters to fight for liberal, progressive, idealistic visions of America that I've always been the only thing that ever saved us. The only thing that ever got us out of a dark spot as a country wasn't somebody saying, oh, look at that awful person, or look at that awful group of people, or let's not let them in, let's block them. No, it's always been the individual, like Emma Lazarus, who said, you know, give me your tired, your poor. So I celebrate you. And it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, thank you, John Nichols. Well, it's always an honor to have you on as well. You know, there were a lot of great progressives of 2015. Just ran down the big progressive victories in the Supreme Court, of course. You know, at the beginning of the year, we had no idea how it would shake out. And it turned out 2015 was the year that gave us finally, yes, the Affordable Care Act is constitutional, and more importantly, I think, same-sex marriage, the law of the land. Again, a year ago at this time, we were light years behind where we are today. So great things are possible, although it seems with each year we are pushing harder against those who would seek to, as you put it, John Nichols, take us backwards. So it
exactly.
is. It really is a battle for the ages. Like, do we move forward? Do we move into the future, or do we, you know, live in the past? And sadly, if you listen to the social pronouncements of the right, you know, they want to take us back to the dark ages. So hopefully, people see that and are willing to step up. I guess, you know, that's what 2016 will bring to us. We'll find that out.
We hope.
All right. So let's go through the nation's 2015 progressive honor roll. The first one that you always have on there is most valuable senator. I know, I think last year or the year before, you guys officially retired Bernie Sanders because he had been there every year for, you know, a few years before that. And then Elizabeth Warren took the mantle, but she's not there. She's not at the top of the list of 2015. Sheldon Whitehouse. And I found this a surprising choice, not because I think Sheldon Whitehouse is anything less than a great progressive, but because he keeps a really low profile. I didn't hear his name much in the news.
Well, that's one of the reasons. One of the things we try to do with the Progressive Honor Roll is to kind of keep pushing outward, looking for new faces, new voices. So it isn't the usual suspects, right?
Right.
And could we put Bernie Sanders up at the top?
Every
again,
year. Yep.
As most progressive senator? I think you probably could. Could you put Elizabeth Warren there?
Yes.
Yes, I think you probably could. I can name a couple others who we've honored in the past, folks like Jeff Merkley out of Oregon, who is just doing incredible work. But I also, when we put this together, and Katrina VandenHeuvel and others of the nation, we talk about, you know, folks who really stand out. One of the things we look for is somebody who's maybe seized an issue. And in 2015, Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, seized the issue of climate change.
Mm.
And it wasn't that he just got into it. I mean, the fact of the matter is he's been working on it for a very long time. But this guy, if you can imagine it, he has gone to the Senate virtually every week and delivered a major speech on climate change. He's delivered dozens of them so that it is in the record. Even when Congress does not act, there is someone there holding the banner up. More importantly, he went to Paris with a group of other senators, or was part of a group of senators, that went to Paris to say to the international negotiators, don't pull your punches. Don't go soft on this issue because you think the United States will not follow along with you. We will back up President Obama in any deal that comes together, and we have beaten the deniers, we've beaten the backward forces in the past using the rules of the Senate, the tools that we have available to us. So don't pull back. Don't, you know, go soft on this. Finally, as a veteran legal scholar, prosecutor, somebody who knows the law, he has been in the forefront of arguing for going after the oil companies in much the same way that we once went after the tobacco companies and said they need to be held to account for lying to us about information they have in their own files and not being truthful about climate change. And so this guy has made it essentially a central part of what he does, and that was why we decided to honor him.
Good choice. Very good choice. Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. And wouldn't it be interesting if someday we saw a White House in the White House?
You know what? When you meet this guy, if you see him in action, we may never have, and that's
right.
Fine, by the way. We may never have somebody who fits the perfect image of a president again in the old historical movies.
Right.
And I think it's good we move beyond that. I want to have people of color and women and,
right.
and, you know, all sorts of diversity in our presidency. So I'm glad not to go backwards. But I will say that, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse actually fits the image
right.
in any way.
And the name. I mean, some would say
exactly.
He's born
yeah.
to it. So anyway, there's that. Most valuable House member. In the Nation magazine's 2015 Progressive Honor Roll, John Nichols, I agree with you on this one, Rosa DeLauro. This 2015, to me, was the battle over, you know, Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It ain't over till it's over, though we lost the battle on Fast Track. We still maybe could win the fight against the TPP, and if we do, it's going to be because of the work of people like Rosa DeLauro.
She's incredible. I mean, Rosa DeLauro, who is a big deal member of Congress. It's important to understand she's been there for a good long time representing Connecticut.
Yep.
She is very respected by leadership. She's worked very, very closely with the White House, with President Obama on a host of women's rights, choice, civil liberties, and all sorts of areas where she's had good alliances with the White House. But on this issue, she did something that is tough. She broke with the president of her own party and said, no, Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all of these other trade agreements that extend from it, that could extend from it, these are bad deals. They're not well designed. They're being negotiated in secret without proper input from Congress. They seem in so many ways to be extensions of corporate power at a time when corporations are so strong and getting stronger all the time. The last thing we need is a trade deal that you know worsens a bad situation. And she used her prominence, her authority, her background as a person who was one of the chief authors of previous Democratic Party national platforms, her close ties to so many people at so many levels, to organize Democrats in the House as a solid block of opposition, first to Fast Track and then to the deal itself, or at least to where we think the deal is at this point. And that is important for two reasons. Number one, if there is a TPP, and I'm increasingly of the view there won't be. But if a Trans-Pacific Partnership does come to pass, it will be better because of the opposition. The White House and negotiators will have been forced to do more because there was opposition. We should always understand that often when we oppose something, we don't stop it, but we make it better.
Right.
So that's first step. But if it is stopped, if it is stopped, I would argue, and I think most members of Congress who treat things seriously would argue, that the work of Rosa DeLauro, in alliance with folks like Keith Ellison of Minnesota and Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Raul Grijalva of Arizona, Congressional Progressive Caucus leaders, yeah. and others, it is their work day in, day out, that really stopped this thing, or at least slowed it down. And it's an incredible accomplishment, because the force, the power that backs these free trade deals, all the corporate power, all the Wall Street power, is quite overwhelming.
Right.
And so I give Rosa DeLauro, who is just tireless, very high marks. And
you know,
she's doing it
yep.
because she represents a part of Connecticut that has been very hard hit by bad trade deals.
Hmm.
She recognizes the real damage.
You know, every press release and Trans-Pacific Partnership is an issue that I pay a lot of attention to. We covered it a lot on this program throughout the year.
I know you did.
Right? But
I wish we had more media like
so
you.
So do I, frankly. You know, let's jump ahead, though, because you did this year. You have a most valuable podcast, and you gave it to Ed Schultz, who, I'll tell you, was when he was on TV, was... I feel pretty confident in saying probably because I'm not 100% sure, but the only person on a cable news channel or, you know, a network for that matter, who regularly talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track. He, you know, and took a strong position. Nowhere else on MSNBC did I see, I mean, even Rachel Maddow, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I never saw talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And obviously, it may have cost him his job.
I don't know about, you know, how they make decisions inside the upper echelon.
Nor do I.
Of networks. But what I do know is this, that at MSNBC, and that's one of the reasons, you know, again, why we recognize this is to, in some ways, to tell people that Ed Schultz is still at it.
Mm-hmm.
He's still making media, as you do and others, using this new model of the podcast as a very powerful tool for getting information out. But here's what I do know, that Ed Schultz did a couple of really amazing things when he was on television. One of them was to bring the issues of working class people, of labor, and of unions to the forefront. And that by its nature ties into the TPP and the European variations on these trade deals. I think that his role was, as you suggest, essential and exposing and challenging. I also would note that he did something else that was incredibly vital. He was initially a supporter of the Keystone Pipeline.
Yes.
And, you know, spoke out for
yep.
it, was pretty enthusiastic in support of it. And then his own viewers, his own listeners said to him, Ed, you really got to check this thing out. You're not right on it.
Right.
But how many people in politics or media, when their listeners or viewers or supporters say you're not right, how many of them say, oh, I better check it out?
Right.
Did, and he changed his position. And so I think that's worthy of note, that there are that exists, that there are people who do that. And with what he's done with the podcast, much like what you do, is he has brought you know, a lot of prominent voices to the fore. In many ways, the podcast that he does recreates a lot of what you saw on TV, and I just want to make sure people are aware of it.
Okay, and that works. And you have a most valuable broadcast media. Oh, by the way, you know what? And well, I'll do that after. Most valuable broadcast media. This one surprised me, because when we think of Democracy Now, I mean, nobody, you know, we always think of Amy Goodman, but you're saluting Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now. And frankly, I see it, but I see it sporadically, because the live broadcast comes on as I'm in the middle of show prep each day. But Democracy Now, I think no one can deny its importance in the world of actual real news broadcasts and truth telling. In this day and age of the commercialized media, and as our my friend Joel Silberman, who's on with me every Monday, he called 2015 the year that brought us the death of the truth in terms of media. Right. That was his big media story of the year, the death of truth. Juan Gonzalez and Democracy Now, they are. Dedicated to actually bringing the truth on television, something that has become almost a rarity these days.
And what I loved about the reason I cited Juan Gonzalez is, A, he's been doing incredible work for a long time. Mm-hmm. He is a veteran. He's at Amy Goodman's side, not every day.
Right.
There's other people like Nermeen Sheikh and others who are just fantastic on that show. But what Gonzalez did, and what he continues to do, is he takes a special interest in a host of issues that are so undercovered. And one of them is the condition of Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And the Puerto Rico, which is a part of the United States,
yep,
highly populated, but not a state in this odd sort of Commonwealth status, is in economic crisis. And it is amazing to me that we have the equivalent in so many ways of an American state that is in, you know, just scorching economic meltdown, facing real challenges because of austerity policies. And most of our media is just scant attention to it. Juan Gonzalez threw himself into that story, told it in a thousand different angles, and kept coming back to it. And in my mind, I love it when somebody like you or somebody like Juan, you know, just grabs a hold of an issue and holds on to it through the whole year.
Right.
Says, I'm not going to let you neglect this.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to let this be denied. And that's what he did, especially with the economic stories coming out of Puerto Rico.
Right. And that Puerto Rico story, I'm pretty sure that if you walk down the street, probably 10 out of 10, unless they had family members in Puerto Rico, would not know that there is a true financial crisis in Puerto Rico happening right now.
Yeah.
They probably wouldn't
yeah.
know that Puerto Rico is not a state or is part of the United States. So it's a bigger problem than just the fact that the media, the new so-called news media, did not report on this Puerto Rico story at all, maybe with the exception
yeah.
of Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now.
You nailed it. And that's why I thought it was very important to highlight. I mean, you know, one of the things that we try to do with the Honor Roll every year is to highlight not just individuals, but the way that individuals raise up particular issues. And so it's as you see with, you know, talking about Senator Whitehouse as regards climate change, talking about Juan Gonzalez as regards the Puerto Rico debt crisis and economic crisis, you know, I'm not that interested in individuals solely because of their individuality. I love people for who they are. But when we talk about this political context, I'm interested in what they do with an issue or with an idea, with a way of moving beyond a politics of personality, which I think we have too much of, toward what we ought to have, which is great debates mm-hmm. about issues and ideas.
Amen. John Nichols is with us. He is the Washington correspondent for The Nation. And each year, he wraps up the year by compiling The Nation's annual Progressive Honor Roll. It's a tradition. We spend at least one segment together going over the best of the year. We'll continue with our look through the best of 2015 with John Nichols of The Nation next. I'm Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com, filling in on the broadcast. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com, in for Brad and Desi for this edition of the broadcast. You know, a new year always presents the opportunity for new beginnings, right? And since neither the broadcast nor the Nicole Sandler Show made the nation's Progressive Honor Roll for 2015, well, there's always 2016, right? John Nichols is with us of The Nation. Every year we get together at the end of the year to go over the nation's choices for the Progressive Honor Roll, looking back on the year almost gone by. And John Nichols, your name is on the Progressive Honor Roll every year, but this is not something you write in a vacuum, right? This is the editors of The Nation. Who all puts this list together?
Well, I always consult with Katrina Bannon, who is the editor and publisher of The Nation and my great colleague. And so we talk about it. But we also, look, we fully recognize our inability to begin to talk about all these issues in and of ourselves. So, yes, other editors are brought in, writers are brought in. I'll ask people. Sometimes we will say to folks who are active around the country, what did you see? Mm. And because we've been doing it now for the better part of 15 years, I'm sorry, not quite that long, 10 years. Mm-hmm. I apologize for extending. But for 10 years. People know it's coming, and, you know, you'll hear toward, you know, like October or November, folks will start, you know, throwing in their nomination, so to speak. And you know, I will tell you, without being too revealing of the secret processes, that one suggestion that we got completely out of the blue ended up framing the choice of best documentary.
Really? Well, then let's talk about. Okay, well, I want to get to that in a second, but before we leave the media section, and you have the most valuable media criticism, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who does great job. And yeah, they sort of, I guess, helped expose Donald Trump for what he is, though, you know, he does a good job of that himself. One of my problems, and it has been ongoing for a while now, never seems to be letting up, is the way some in the media and some who criticize the media call it the liberal media. And in fact, if you watch television, you'd be hard-pressed to find a liberal voice left, you know, now that MSNBC made its transition to MS. Mm-hmm. It went from MSNBC to MSDNC to MSRNC to MST Rump. Now, I don't know what they're doing these days, except for a couple of hours at night. You know, I got so tired of hearing the liberal media, that I thought it was time to basically put together a directory, because there is liberal media. We're just not in the traditional mainstream venues. So I went looking for, like, the URL, theliberalmedia.com.net.org. Every permutation of the liberal media was taken and parked. I'm guessing it was somebody from Breitbart or Drudge who has too much money and too much time on their hands. But, you know, they're releasing all these new suffixes, these new URL suffixes. So I was able to get in on the ground floor, and I reserved theliberal.media. So theliberal.media, if you go there, is a directory of the liberal media, and I'm always willing to add to it if anybody notices that
we got to raise that up.
Yeah.
We should do more to highlight that.
Yes.
That's fabulous.
So it's there, theliberal.media, and I'm always encouraging people, if I left off anybody off, email me, we'll put them on there. This is democracy. But the you know, and in terms of the news sites that are included on there, you know, that's sort of questionable, because I think the truth has a liberal bias to it, right? So, you know, The Nation is in there. I don't think The Nation is necessarily a liberal publication. I think you're dedicated to the truth. And sometimes,
well, I think also that The Nation, like so many publications, and maybe even like your show, you know, we evolve over time. And so one of the problems I have with saying that something is liberal or conservative media, right, is that, you know, what was liberal at one time may evolve what was conservative at one time. You know, the fact of the matter is, you know, I look at conservative media, and I think it horribly serves the conservative movement.
Terribly.
Right? Because it tends to raise up personalities and sort of this cheap shot politics, which is very, very much, it's very much about, you know, attacking the other side rather than actually standing for anything.
That's right.
And I think one of the reasons why conservatives today, why they may turn to Trump, why they feel so alienated and so angry and frustrated, while they won't admit it, maybe they don't even understand it, is because they've been told now for decades that, you know, everybody's against them, everything's horrible, they're under attack, and I'm not even sure they even know what they're for anymore. You know, they just, what's called conservative media is essentially a media of anger and opposition to that which it isn't, whatever that is. And I think it is vital for us to understand that as we talk about media, what we want is folks who do tell their truth. And frankly, folks who optimistically advance ideals, who say, I'm for this, I want more of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is there are some conservative ideas that are great, which I would be very sympathetic to. But you never hear them advanced anymore. You certainly don't hear them advanced by Donald Trump, but frankly, the whole of the Republican presidential crew is at odds with what I would think of as traditional and valid conservatives.
Right. And in many cases, the truth. I mean, there was something the other day, you know, when on social media things get out of control and people are defending like the lies and nonsense spewed by Donald Trump, and to, you know, as proof that they're right, to back up their contention, they'll cite, you know, something from Breitbart News. Well, that's an oxymoron if I ever heard one. Breitbart is not news. And you know what? His organization should have died when he did, because it does a disservice to the truth.
It's not news.
That's the thing, though. I have a problem when something calls itself news and it's propaganda, or it's made up stuff, or it's, you know, it's pushing false narratives. And that's what Breitbart does. He did it when he was alive, and his tradition, I think, lives on. I have a problem, you know, with on cable TV. Fox can call itself news because the FCC has no jurisdiction over cable in that sense. They couldn't put that channel, say, on the Fox television network and call it news because they make stuff up. And the FCC could step in, not that they would, but they could, and stop them from calling themselves news. I think there's a problem there when there's no quality control, as it were. Though I don't know who would do the quality control. I guess that's up to the customer.
That is the real problem, of course, because you never, you know, when we start to talk about, you know, what makes for good or bad, I mean, obviously that's got to be defined largely by the market, you know. And so what we really need to do is raise up the quality of all of our media, and that's both right and the left, and to have more ideas involved. And the only thing I'll say as regards the Breitbart folks, for what it's worth, is, I probably disagree with them on everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say that there would be anything in which I would agree with them. And yet they, at a certain period this year, when all of the media was attacking Trump, or not attacking, but was dismissing Trump, a lot of the Breitbart folks raised Trump up and said, you know, look, there's something here that a lot of people are into. Now, it happens, I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not where I'm at. But I was fascinated by the role that they played, because I think that they countered a narrative that existed even in conservative media. And so I am a fan, frankly, of media that challenges existing orders, existing structures, that pushes things out, that blows things up. Now, that's the first baseline that we ought to have, is, you know, it's not news, or it's not, you know, worthwhile discourse if it's not saying something we don't know, right? It should be pushing in new directions. And the second standard, though, and this is the deeper one, which I think most of our media falls apart on, and this goes across all of our mainstream media and even beyond that, is the notion that, you know, why are we doing what we're doing? What is the purpose of what we do? And I would argue that the purpose of what we do is to inform people so they can govern themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
To give people the information they need to guide their own affairs. It's effectively empowerment. And I think that most of our media now is about profit. And profits and empowerment don't always go along well with one another. We have a lot of history that tells us that they can often be at odds with one another. And so it strikes me that when we talk about what media ought to be, you know, our first standard ought to be, I mean, even things we don't like, that media ought to challenge existing orders. It ought to throw things off. It ought to shake things up, because that's a very deep historic tradition and a good one. But secondly, it ought to recognize that the value of reporting things and of speaking about stuff and analyzing and commenting is that we help citizens to become more engaged. And how do we know that most of our media fails today? Well, I've got an easy answer for you on that. In local elections across this country, we often have turnout of under 10%.
Yeah.
In state elections, we often have a turnout of under 40%.
Yeah.
In presidential elections, we often have a turnout around 50%, a little bit over. And those are the measures of an absolutely failed media, because when most people don't vote, we either have to assume that people are bad, right, that there's something wrong with them, or we have to assume that as consumers of our media system, they don't get enough sustenance.
Right.
They don't get enough encouragement to go out and participate.
That's right. And that is the problem. And I think part of it is, you know, and my criticism of Breitbart is the fact that they call themselves news when they're not. Opinion, look, and this program, I don't say is a news program. We are based in news, but I offer opinion based in fact. And my listeners know if I ever get something wrong, I want them to correct me. I want to come on the air the next day and say, all right, correction department, here's what I messed up yesterday, because I don't want to be the purveyor of misinformation. But it seems that that's what some of these right-wing media sites that call themselves news thrive on, and that's the problem I have.
Well, I think the term news, right,
is
I hate to tell you, I see a lot of evening newscasts.
Yeah, that are not.
Boy, when I'm watching exercise tips and the weather the 15th time, I'm starting to wonder how much whether that could, maybe that's our great challenge for 2016, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's our great challenge. Take on a local evening newscast and do it on a false advertising.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Ooh.
You know, how much of this is news?
It's real news. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Ooh, there's a challenge. All right, a few more before we run. John Nichols of The Nation. You mentioned the most valuable documentary. Honestly, I hadn't heard of We Are Many, but it looks fascinating. And this was brought to your attention by readers?
Basically a friend of the magazine who said, you know, look, I know you usually recognize the documentary. Have you seen this one? Have you checked it out? And I hadn't. And I don't know that Katrina had either or others. And so we checked it out, and boy, we were just blown away. Because it sort of does – there are a lot of good documentaries, by the way, in 2015. It was a rich year of many good documentaries, even one marking the 100th anniversary of The Nation magazine. But when I saw this We Are Many – it was so unimaginably powerful because it recalled the overwhelming international opposition to a war in Iraq. And it showed these incredible protests, the millions who went to the streets believing in our right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances. And it was such a beautiful, powerful, brilliant expression of that anti-war statement. Now, many people would say, yeah, but why is that great? Because, of course, they didn't succeed. They didn't stop the war. And it's true. George Bush and Tony Blair, they got their war. They got the war they wanted.
Yep.
The absolute disaster that haunts us to this day. But what this filmmaker does, which is so absolutely valid, is to show what those people did next. And they went out and they became the underpinnings of movements, you know, for things that we don't necessarily associate with the anti-war movement of 2002, 2003, Arab Spring, Occupy, efforts to push back against austerity around the world. People trace activism back to those anti-war marches in 2003.
That's
right. And so he does this brilliant job of linking it all up and making us understand that an arc of history may have, you know, we may have started one arc of history with these marches against a war that wasn't stopped. But that arc of history isn't done, and it is bending toward justice.
Yes, it is. And I'll have to go check this out. You know, a lot of us, the news media didn't report on the Iraq war protests when they were happening either. So this We Are Many is one to put on the list. Most valuable rock album, sadly, one that a lot of people didn't hear unless you're a Neil Young fan, which I am, The Monsanto Years. How awesome is it of Neil Young to do a rock album? You know, this is the man who brought us Living with War, the best musical indictment of the Bush Wars imaginable. Yep. Now he brings us The Monsanto Years by Neil Young and Promise of the Real.
And they take on Monsanto, one of the biggest multinational corporations in the world, genetic modification of food, Starbucks, the food system in general. I mean, these are huge, major institutions and topics on behalf of safe, healthy food.
Right.
And it just opens up the discourse. I don't care where people happen to be on, you know, in these debates about food policy. I mean, I care personally. But what I'm saying is no matter where you're at, this album is an incredible educational and intellectual statement, and it rocks.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that Promise of the Real, which is Willie Nelson's kids and friends, along with Neil Young, they recreate some of the great sound, the great feel. If you're a fan of Neil Young and
yes,
Crazy Chords.
Big time.
But yeah. I think Neil Young was really rocking it at just this incredibly edgy, powerful feel. I think they hit that mark.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I honestly, if you didn't even care about these issues at all, this is a pretty cool album.
Yeah.
It's got a great rocking feel.
Yeah.
If you do care about the issues, I think it's a revelation.
Right. It is the masterpiece of the year. All right. Finally, John Nichols, we're not hitting on every category for that.
Of course. I point
to people to thenation.com, this year's most valuable progressives. I'll link to it from my blog at radioornot.com. We'll link to it from the Brad blog as well, because we'll run this segment on the Bradcast. I want to wrap up, John Nichols, with the most valuable ideological comeback, which is democratic socialism. I knew you'd find a way to put Bernie Sanders in here.
Well, it's not just for any individual.
I know. Right?
Although Sanders, you cannot deny the role that he has played in putting this ideology back in play. You know, literally watching him on national talk shows explaining democratic socialism. I mean, we didn't see a lot of that for the last, say, 100 years.
We didn't see Bernie Sanders either for all the years he'd been in the Senate and in the House before that. You know, last year, I think it was in 2014, might have been when Chuck Todd took over Meet the Press, they initiated this new segment, Meet the Candidates. And again, it was the end of 2014. It was before the 2014 elections. Bernie Sanders was not running for anything. He hadn't declared for the presidency yet. It was ahead of the 2014 election. So there were 435 House members up for reelection and probably at least 33 Senate seats up as well.
Yep.
For their inaugural segment of Meet the Candidates, they couldn't bring in an actual candidate. They brought in the guy that they thought might be running against Hillary Clinton. That was the first time Bernie Sanders was ever on Meet the Press. I found it.
No, I mean, it's ridiculous. the disengagement historically of our media with ideological diversity.
Yep.
I mean, Bernie Sanders and in many countries around the world, Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul would have been your regulars,
right?
On these shows, not because they're always right, or even because you always agree with them, but they're interesting and they have perspective and they say things and they go to unexpected places rather than having John McCain literally, you know, have his own personal chair on the set. And so, yes, Sanders has broken through and pushed some ideas into the mix, but we should not fail to note that this comes in the context of a moment. First off, when Sanders talked about democratic socialism, Martin O'Malley might say he disagrees, he doesn't believe we have to go to socialism, but he doesn't reject it as somehow completely unacceptable or horrid. Hillary Clinton, to her immense credit, she's gone back and forth with Sanders on a number of things, has not said, socialism is an unacceptable idea or democratic socialism is something we can't even mention. I mean, so we have seen on the Democratic side, striking progress for opening up the discourse, for accepting more ideas. Much has happened on the Republican side historically as the Libertarians came in, and they initially were rejected and then forced the Republican Party to at least acknowledge the reality of a Libertarian movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see things happening that are important, and I would also give some credit to Shama Sawant,
yes,
the Socialist City Council member up in Seattle. In the piece there in the settlement, we note Jacobin magazine, a young, fresh, very strong magazine that is, you know, really raising all these issues and about to do, I think, an ABC of socialism. You know, sort of basically some answers to all the questions that are in play. We have a dynamic moment going on. And I would even include in that dynamic moment Ted Cruz and maybe even sometimes Donald Trump, because they're attacking Bernie Sanders, right?
Yeah,
they're criticizing the fact that I think that's fine, because in the end of the day, if we acknowledge that there are alternative economic ideas, we have already moved so far beyond the empty, corrupt, stupid debates of the past that, I got to feel like sorry, as difficult as 2015 was, I feel like we're progressing.
Moving in the right direction, John Nichols, huh?
A little bit.
Yeah. That feels good. Well, hopefully. And we'll see where we are a year from now. We have a date.
All right, my friend. I hope we talk many times in between.
As do I.
And I want to wish you all the very best as you enter into new adventures.
Thank you so much. John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation. It is always my honor to have you on the show. I love our discussions. I appreciate your work more than words can express. Thank you so much for being here today. Your wisdom and insights with us, John Nichols of The Nation. Happy New Year.
Thanks, Nicole. Happy New Year.
The Nation's John Nichols, helping me wrap up 2015 here on the broadcast. A few thoughts before I sign off. I was thrilled when Brad Friedman decided to take the broadcast to 5 days a week. With so little airtime devoted to real news and information actually based in fact, it's important that Brad's work be heard. I hope that you're able to support the broadcast too, because it's imperative that we make sure shows like his are able to continue. I also hope that if you haven't already done so, you'll check out my show over at RadioOrNot.com. I'm on live weekday mornings from 10 to noon Eastern, but the show is available anytime, always free. It's posted on the blog. It's available as a podcast, you know, in all the usual places. Like Brad, my show is listener-supported too. Well, I've got to wrap things up now, as I've got a wedding to get to, my own. It's taken me more than half a century to get here, so I don't want to be late. So, have a safe and happy new year. Healthy, happy, prosperous, and democratic new year. Until next time, I'm Nicole Sandler of Radio or Not, your guest host on the broadcast. 2016, here we come.